Here we are for the Filthy Lip Out yet again with our sponsors, Mercaddy, and obviously the number one electric trolley in golf. Now, you got me, Johnny Morgan, Kit Alexander, and, well, the main man who's Caddy for great names on the bag. I mean, Mr. Wonderman, the comedian, the one and only Billy Foster. Billy Foster, how you doing, buddy? With the win under your belt, just coming off it, back from Dubai. Mate, you must be knackered.
Bit of a sore head, Morgan, I think, really.
Yeah?
Yeah, I don't blame you. A long trip back that flew to London and then had a couple of hours in London in the German gymnasium next door to King's Cross, and then they got the train up, and then had a few walked through the door and Congratulations was playing, and a few glasses of champagne were waiting on the table for me. So yeah, it was a nice welcome home.
Oh, back on it again, mate. I mean, what was it like?
You counted off perfect, yeah.
I mean, what's it like coming up there with such a, I mean, I got to say, Matt Fitzpatrick, I got to follow him at one of your lovely, venues that you've done well at in the past, at Crans Montana. And I tell you what, he went on to win there and I couldn't believe how good he was. How he shapes it, how he rips it so low, he can change ball flights willy-nilly, you know, and he puts like Houdini, doesn't he? So it's, you know, match made in heaven, really.
Yeah, he's... You know, at the start of the season, he was 25th in the world rankings, and sort of like sat down at the start of the year. So, well, if he can finish 20th in the world rankings at the end of this season, it's all be a great year, you know. And I think he's actually 16th this morning after that. So, it's all good strides, Morgan. But, you know, you still identify little bits of his game that there's room for improvements. Well, 21, if he can tidy up them two or three key areas that he... I feel as though he can get better, and there's no reason why he can't challenge the top 10.
It was really noticeable, I found, watching on Sunday, the relationship between the two of you, and there had been a few comments on social media as well, how much you seem to be helping in that situation. As a caddy, how much do you feel you bring to the team, and particularly in those moments when it's crucial, you can add that extra little piece that helps your man, in this case, Matt, get over the line?
At the end of the day, that's my 38th year caddy, and you learn by your daggers and your swords and your mistakes that you've made over them years, you know, and only experience can drag you through those situations. And, you know, Matt hadn't won for a couple of years, and it's a number of years since I won a good tournament with anybody. So, you know, you see, deep inside you are squirming a little bit, but... you know, the old head and the scars that you've had, the battle scars, keep you quite cool under the, you know, the over the heat, the last 9 holes, which was, he played great the first 7 holes, 5 under after 7, and then he just did what he had to do. You know, he had that 3-shot cushion and he just kept churning the pars out, you know, and he actually had a really good shot on 17. It was pretty unlucky, really. The wind were left to right and it never moved it a yard, I think. You know, in the air, it looked as though it were going to be 15 feet, and then he ended up getting a bad bounce down in the Valley of Snakes. Like, it was horrible down there, you know, really yeah. Snarly in the rain. And of course, he tried to finish me off. You know, I'm 55 in a couple of weeks, and when he rammed it 5.5 foot past from about 20 feet, I wanted to throw him in the lake. But, you win tournaments by limiting your mistakes, and it's just a case of trying to slow your thought process down and just avoiding stupid mistakes. So you've got to keep quite cool under them circumstances. But there were some really tricky decisions to be made them the last few holes, you know, because he kept just hitting it in the rough, you know, and it's, is it going to come out dead? Is it going to come out flying? Especially the one on 16, it was 160 yards down breeze out of the rough. And you're thinking, well, if he hits a wedge and it comes out of the top of the club, it's in the water short. If he hits a 9-iron and gets a fire, it could kill the cameraman at the top of the TV tower behind the green. It was a horrible one over the water, you know, so... I tried to reiterate for him to hit it further left than he wanted to, which he did, and he got the slope and fortunately came down and finished 20 feet. So, yeah, but it was never easy all the way, and even the last, you know, he drove it in the rough, and it's a smelly layup because there's water everywhere snaking around, and I actually walked up about 120 yards just to make sure that there was no guesstimates involved. I wanted to be 100% sure of exactly where I needed to land in. It worked out just a nice 8-iron. Up the right side, but then of course he bashed that 3-foot pass just to try and finish me off again. But the good thing was I didn't know what the prize money was. I just thought it was just a normal event, so it was a pleasant surprise when Westy told me how much we'd won walking off the last green. I nearly fell over.
Yes.
It was a good day for the new boss and a good day for the old boss. So it was great. Yeah.
Well, exactly. I was going to ask about that. Obviously, because Westy, you're synonymous with. You caddied for Lee Westwood for 10 years and probably a bit bittersweet because Matt was so close to winning the race to Dubai as well. But
that's another thing. I never give it a thought. I didn't think even Matt could win the money list. I never even realised that he actually would have won it if Lottie Cantona had a double 17. I wasn't aware of that. It obviously be a nice prestigious title for Matt to have, but monetary rise, it wasn't much difference at all. So I didn't even know he could win it.
Mm-hmm. We had Laurie Cantor on the podcast before, and he's such a nice lad, and he's had a good season. What was it like playing with him on that final day?
Yeah, lovely lad. You know, he played pretty solid. You know, he had a couple of poor holes, and obviously 17 killed him. You know, and he actually missed a great chance on 16 from probably about 7 or 8 feet. You know, just a little bit. Yeah, he's obviously seen Matt's putt trickle to the hole and go 3 foot past. So he obviously didn't want to be giving it a roll and just tickled it down and it just drifted off. But, you know, if it had all that, he'd have genuinely had a chance to win the tournament. But obviously the double on 17 killed him off. But lovely lad, bombs it. He's a long way and he's got a bright future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a local lad to me, actually. He's a player. I remember giving him a little chat. I think I was playing for Somerset at the time. So, I give him a little big up chat. I can't say what I said, obviously. Yeah, it seems to have given him a good kick up the backside anyway. So he's doing what he does and he's brilliant, isn't he?
I did speak to him on the first day because obviously I caddied for Gordon Brown Jr. for 5 years and
did
a couple of round cuts with Gordon. Obviously, Gordon taught Lottie when he was a bit younger, I guess. So.
Yeah, would have done, mate. I mean, let's talk about those wins, boss, because you've had some memorable ones, to say the least. I mean, especially the one that happened last week. But talk us through Gordon Brown Jr. and obviously the main man, Seve Ballesteros. I mean, it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you'd obviously know Gordon. Gordon was a character, to say the least. You know, he's if you didn't know him, you probably wouldn't particularly like him that much. But once you knew him, you knew how fun, sarcastic and, you know, tongue-in-cheek he was. He was cheeky chappy and it was always fun to be around. It was hard work on a golf course. He had his moments, but, you know, he's a very underrated player, Gordon. You know, he finished fourth in the money list. 1987, made the Ryder Cup team, the first Ryder Cup team that won in America at Muirfield Village. And a wonderful shot maker that was massively underrated as a golfer. Wasn't a fantastic putter. Should have probably done better with his career than he did, but very, very good, big talent, Gordon. And, you know, two Ryder Cups is a testament to what a good player he was.
Yeah,
what was that Ryder like for you going over to Muirfield Village in 1987? Your first experience of that event in America with the fans and how it played out in the end?
Well, my first impression, I'll never forget it, when I got to Muirfield Village, I was looking out over the golf course as we arrived. I thought, what are all those little greens about? You know, like little greens everywhere. And I realised it were the tees. I'd never experienced a golf course in such pristine condition. You know, when you're from Yorkshire and travelling around the, you know, the poorer courses of Europe and you get there, it was a different level, like, you know, and... It was a special occasion, you know, but my memory, we stood in the middle of the 17th fairway waiting to hit a second shot into the 17th playing Hal Sutton and Seve all the winning putt in front and they were dancing and partying on the green for 20 minutes and I'm stood in the fairway 200 yards up the fairway like a spare dick at a wedding, like, you know, so my head were off. I wasn't celebrating, just stood there for 20 minutes waiting for everything to die down, but it was a great experience and you know, I've been very fortunate to carry on and do 14 Ryder Cups and been on the winning team most of them times. Obviously, it's been a great period for European golf.
That's incredible to have done 14 Ryder Cups. We talk about the players and their longevity, how many they've done, but you've been at more than anyone, really. Certainly.
Nick Faldo did 11, rookie.
Yeah. So you've long surpassed.
Yeah, rookie.
I've done 13 Ryder Cups, but I was in Paris as an assistant as such to vice captaincy and stuff. So it was still going around doing jobs and stuff. But
and next year,
looking forward to them, hopefully.
I mean, yeah, next year you're more than likely to be there with Matt, of course. What is it like to be a caddy at a Ryder Cup?
Well, there's no other golf tournament like it. You know, I've been very fortunate to be in the last group of the Masters and the last group of the Open, etc. And the Ryder Cup makes the Masters and the Open feel like you're playing a pro-am, atmosphere-wise. Because it is golf with a football crowd, you don't normally get the noise levels of, you know, and the hatred and passion as such, you know, that the Ryder Cup brings to the party. You know, it's, you know, and for lads that have never been there and done it, it's, you can find yourself, your emotions running away with you a little bit, but, you know, and get affected by the crowd being against you. But I, you know, you get used to it. I love it. I embrace it. And, you know,
oh, yeah, bloody right.
That's it, when everybody's against you, it's brilliant. I just laugh at them. It's brilliant. Some of the dogs abuse you get over there, I'll just laugh at them. I mean, I'll never forget.
What's one of the funniest things you've had on the
Hazeltine, Westwood's looking at this 30-foot putt. He said, Billy, come and read this. So I'm looking at it, thinking it's a bit left to right. And this guy in the crowd goes, hey, Westwood, you turd! And I just looked up the sand and put my thumb up and went, yeah, nice call, mate. Brilliant, brilliant. And now I'm on my hands and knees looking at this putt. And Westwood goes, what do you think? I says, it's a cup outside the left now. Knock it in, you turd, and walked away. we were playing with Danny Willett that day, and obviously Danny's Willett's brother had come out with an article which had gone down like a web. I think he said it tongue in cheek, and it came across terribly. But
yeah,
it was horrible for Danny. The dog's abuse he were getting shouted at him every hole, 25 times per hole for 18 holes. It was pretty brutal out there. But and he got a man up and get on with it. And you know, there's only one way to shut him up, and that's play a better golf and all a few putts and keep him quiet. It's the only way to do it.
Yeah, bloody right.
What would be your favourite Ryder Cup moment if you had to pick one out?
2006 Ryder Cup, caddying for Davin Clark 6 weeks after his wife died. And obviously, and also at the same time as Stenson all the putts. You know, everybody around that green thought Davin had actually won the Ryder Cup, but technically Stenson all the winning putt. But obviously hugging Davin, who broke down in tears, having won the Ryder Cup, and, you know, so shortly after his wife had passed away. So that will be my, probably my most special memory in golf in 38 years of caddy. And I mean, even if you go in and win a major, that'll take some beating that particular moment.
It was
up there with, you know, I'm walking onto the first tee, you know, I started crying on the first tee. The noise levels was that, the atmosphere, the passion, the emotion of it, and the noise levels, I started crying on the first tee. It's like, how is he going to make this tee shot? You know, it was immense week. And, you know, to win it 18.5 to 9.5 and give him a proper battering was pretty special.
Yeah. And for Billy, I mean, that's an amazing story, boss. And yeah, I echo that. I mean, that's got to be the best of anything. But I got to ask you a question. This goes for probably players and caddies as well, you know, together. How do you get a rapport with your player? You know, you've had great players. You know, how do you feed a rapport? How do you gain the trust and stuff like that? I mean, being a player, you know, it's not easy sometimes to get the rapport that you need and get things ticking along. You know, what have you been able to do and achieve? You know, and is there any kind of insight there?
First and foremost, you've got to get the respect by doing your job properly, you know, and putting the hours in, the homework in before the week starts, and you know, not guessing any stuff. You know, you can't be 95% sure of the information that you're giving. You need to be 100% sure. So if the player can see that you've done your own work and he trusts implicitly what you bring to the party, that's where you get the respect value. But ultimately, you need to get on with them and be a mate as well, you know. And you know, you can be a good caddy, but if you're not on the same page, same wavelength, same sense of humour, you ain't going to last. You know, it's like you are 30 weeks a year on tour, 10 hours a day with your boss, 7 days a week, and you're basically married to him. So you need to be able to get on with your on-course wife, and if you don't, it'll all end up in divorce, which it often does.
You know?
Yeah. Well, you've caddied for an incredible list of golfers. We've touched on Gordon Brown Jr. and Darren Clark, and also Hugh Baiocchi was where you started out, your first ever job. Now, he's someone I wasn't overly familiar with, I have to admit, being perhaps a little bit on the younger side, but we've had Dale Hayes and Tony Johnston on. They've spoken about what a good player Hugh Baiocchi was, and I've kind of looked into him a bit. And from your point of view, as a first player that you properly caddied for full time, what was that like, and what did Hugh give you that enabled you to kick on and do what you've done the rest of your career?
Well, it's funny how it came about, really, because I was working with my dad as an apprentice joiner, getting 20 quid a week and getting sacked three times a week. And later, man said, let's go to a few tournaments in Britain, which we did. And then he said, let's go to Spain on a 6 weeks holiday. So we went down there and I ended up caddying at the Portuguese Open for Tony Johnson.
And we played,
we played a practice round with Hugh Baiocchi. And Tony finished seventh in the Portuguese Open and won a massive amount of €1,000. So I got 5% of that, €50. And the caddy pays his own expenses. So I get to Portugal and you couldn't afford to fly as a caddy. So you like get on buses and overnight trains and sleeping rough. I slept in a bush one night and, you know, it was tough. You stayed in absolute hovels with rats running around. It was terrible. No yardage books, no internet, no mobile phones. You know, there was nothing like it. It was a tough existence. Like, so I ended up caddying for Tony Johnson. And at the end of the week, Hugh Baiocchi came to me and said, you know, I like your attitude as a caddy. Do you fancy coming working for me next year? And I sort of like, yeah, that'd be great, Hugh, why not? And I looked at it, it just finished 12th on the money list. So to go from obscurity to straight into, like, you know, a top 20 job in Europe was a stroke of luck, you know. And a lovely man and probably the nicest gentleman I've ever come across on tour or up there, with the likes of Nick Price, people like that. Hughie was an absolute gentleman and a great player. I think he finished second on the money list in the few years previous to that. And it just goes to show he never even got an invite for the Masters. You know, when he finished second on the European money list, that's how it was back then. And
yeah.
A junior finished fourth on the money list, no sign of an invite to the US Open or the Masters or anything. Like, it was tough for European players back then, you know. So, but Hughie was a gentleman and I went down to South Africa, did the full Sunshine Circuit down there for 12 weeks and I was the only white caddy.
You know, really? It's
almost 155 black caddies and me. And somehow I got them on my side. You know, it was, taking my life in my own hands, really. Nick pinching a job. That's the way they look at it. But
yeah,
I got on with them well. And it was a tough learning curve the first 2 or 3 years on tour for me. But I won't swap it for the world. Swap it. It's been a good upbringing and it makes you appreciate everything that we have now, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Seve Ballesteros, you worked for 5 years, that absolute legend. I know there are so many stories, but what was he like as a person? Like you say, you're a married couple when you're on tour. You get to know him so well, you're in each other's pockets. Just give us some insight into the type of human being Seve was just on a day-to-day level.
Well, he's definitely the most miraculous shot maker that'll ever play the game. And obviously, technology in the golf ball doesn't allow you to move the ball like you. You know, that's another story that winds
up. Damn it, that's one of my questions gone.
No. It's absolutely, to see the shot makers that I've grown up watching the last 30-odd years on tour, to see how the game's played now, makes me want to get the sick bucket out. Shot making's finished, and it makes the brilliant golfers and the average golfers so much closer together. As back in the day, the great golfers were the great golfers. Shot making at its best, you know. Those days are finished. And hopefully they do something with the ball to rein it back in again a little bit and make the courses more playable. I'm sick of, 4,000-yard golf courses. It's going that way. And you've flown a drive 502 yards off the tee. That's where it's going. It's horrible.
Yeah.
I hate it. But anyway, I can't remember your question now. What
Seve, does that tell us
No, obviously, with the best shot maker that will ever play the game. You know, he had a mixture between Ben Hogan and Hulk Hogan on the golf course. You know, you don't know what you're going to get from minute to minute. You know, he was stubborn, tough man to work for. You had to stand up to the plate and fight your own corner. And I fought fire with fire. You know, the first few weeks on the job, I showed him a lot of respect, but was probably a little bit humble and, you know, but the Yorkshire Terrier came out of me and I fought fire with fire. And I think, you know, if you lasted five holes with Seve, you were doing well back then. So 5 years was a pretty good effort, you know. But eventually I got sacked for taking him at the side of the clubhouse at Augusta National and ripping him into pieces, like, and telling him exactly what I thought. So I dug my own grave there. But he wanted me to come back, but I'd moved on with Darren Clark a couple of months later. And Seve were coming to the end of his career and Darren was starting his. So it never went back, but I got some wonderful messages and letters and emails off his brothers, etc. Obviously, when he was poorly and then ultimately passing away. I got some really nice messages and text messages from Seve himself. So it's they're filed away and laminated, and I'll cherish until the day I die. Like, you know, but absolute legend of a man and an incredible talent of, you know, there's only one player now I can sort of like, that plays the game now, I can sort of like relate to how he moves the ball around, and is Bubba Watson.
Yeah. Yeah.
Totally. He's the only player I can see out there that really shapes the ball, and but he has to do obscene things to make it do that. But
yeah. I said this conversation, I've had this conversation with Kit, Billy, just saying that that kind of craftsmanship of the game is definitely going, unfortunately. I mean, just going back to Crans Montana, I know you're going to tell, I got to ask you a story about Seve, obviously, with the wall. I mean, I attempted it with you, and I know you took some footage and you put out the first tape, which, damn it, I hit the wall. But anyway, Matt, when I was, Matt Fitzpatrick, your main man, he was playing the sixth hole, and now he goes on to win it, right? He goes on to win. I give him the winner's interview, and in, during the course of that round, I mean, he is a shot shaper without question. He's definitely a shot shaper, and he loves to see some movement on the ball and get it working ball flight wise. He loves to bring it down, hit it. And he hits his eye as your head, you know, straight off the bat, off the tee, and thread it through those trees up onto the front edge of the green. I thought, my God, this boy's got the lot. What do you think of him?
Yeah, he's really impressive, that knuckleball. It's like you say, it's probably 8 or 10 foot on the ground, you know, it's off the ground. It's an absolute bullet that cutting the grass as it goes off the tee, and it runs out there 280. It's an incredible goal shot. I've never seen another player in my time that can hit that low. It is incredible. He does have a lot of good golf shots. And I call him Bernard Langer's love child. You know, he's that professional, the way he goes about everything. You know, he's got a big future in front of him. Yeah.
Well, his boy, was it his brother, Alex? Have you ever got to see him play? Have you?
I've never really seen Alex, but I know, you know, he probably bombs it 30 yards past Matthew. But it's what's between a pair of ears that counts in this game, Morgan. You know that.
That's true.
Seeing up and bombing it 350, but you need the old package and the mentality to go with it. Whether that's Alex true. Has got that, I'm not sure. I don't really know his game well enough, but he's obviously a very talented young man that played the Walker Cup, so he's.
Yeah,
trying to follow in his brother's footsteps.
Definitely. One thing I wanted to ask, and it's kind of, we brought it up a little bit there, that the shot making isn't in the game anymore, but it's so much about bombing it. Matt is almost an old school golfer in the way he goes about things and his ability to shape the ball. He isn't a bomber off the tee. You sometimes hear that he maybe needs to get longer if he wants to be absolutely elite. I'm not sure that's the case, because the rest of his game is so good. The short game, the putting is absolutely elite. We've seen him win against big fields in big events already in his career. You mentioned earlier there are two or three areas where you believe he can improve to really kick on and get into those top 10. Just how good is he right now? And what do you feel are those little extra pieces he needs to really go to the next level?
Well, right now, he's obviously 16th in the world, so the answer, the proof's in the pudding, you know, he's going in the right direction. But, you know, I don't elaborate too much on slagging him off, because he's really good. But the areas I can see him needing to sharpen it a little bit is his wedge play's not quite sharp enough. You know, he's got to look at the likes of, I always go on about Zach Johnson's got a green jacket and a claret jug. You know, Luke Donald got to number one in the world, you know. Certainly. Playing like me at times, but you know, getting from 140 yards in, absolute dynamite. You know, bunker play could be a little bit tighter. His chipping could be a little bit better. You know, the simple shots. So they're the areas that he can improve a little bit. So if he can work hard at that, and you know, and bring his, you know, his scoring average down a couple of shots a week just through basic better wedge play, or you know, chipping it stiff instead of chipping it to 6 foot and missing. You know, it's man, he don't miss
exactly.
Yeah, but they're the areas that can probably, you know, save another couple of shots a week, which ultimately will be the difference between finishing fifth and winning, you know.
And just as well, because you look at the stats and he's a brilliant, brilliant putter. You've seen many of the best golfers, the best putters in the world over the last 2-3 decades. Where does Matt rank? How good is his putting?
He's up there with, you know, I've always had a bit of a tendency for to carry for players that aren't really putting the best. You know, they could have been, but, you know, it's like Hugh Bioki was tentative, Gordon Brown Jr., tentative, said he were brilliant. You know, Sergio Garcia had his issues. Darren Clark wasn't the best putter. Lee Westwood would probably have had, if he'd have put it like Matt Fitzpatrick, he'd probably have 3 claret jugs and 5 Masters jackets. You know, it's that's the way it is. But everybody's got a little bit of a weakness in the game. And but Matt's definitely a very positive putter. His pace is brilliant. Give me an heart attack when he hit 5.5-foot pass on 17 on Sunday. I'll give him that. Want to throw him in water. It's the strongest part of his game for sure. And obviously his driving's impeccable too. So,
very good.
Yeah, but he's a brilliant putter, really. He's the best putter I've probably carried for, in fairness, which is always nice, you know.
Yeah.
You know, when he's over a 3-footer, you feel as though 98 times out of 100, it's not even worth watching. He's just going to knock it in, you know. You know, and back with a few of others, you sort of like biting your nails a bit. But with him, you don't tend to worry too much.
Well, going back to Crans-Montana, and let's talk about the taxi bar and a few nice little joints that you must have had in there, you know, just having a few sherbets. But let's talk about the main man, Seve Ballesteros, and that moment near the wall, man. Talk us through it. You know, you're coming up that 18th hole, you know, someone's lying down there, he blocks it, move right. Tell us all about this whole fiasco, man, because where you tell it, and I've heard you tell it, it is
he wasn't really in the tournament, and he was 5 shots off the lead with 6 holes to play in the last round, and he birdied 13, 14, 15, 16 and 17, 5 in a row, tied for the lead, played the last, and he hit a 3-wood and slashed it 50 yards straight right, bounced down the hill behind this wall, and I've got there first, and you know exactly, Morgan,
yeah,
when I put that ball that day, when you hit it, it'd be within inches of where that ball actually was, and you know, there's that bent tree behind, you've got your backswing's blocked a little bit, and then you've got to get it up over an 8-foot wall, 9-foot wall, whatever it is. And then over the top of the wall is a load of fir trees, a few chinks of daylight. And I've gone down there. And then you've got to get it over the... It's a different hole now, but there used to be like 4 80-foot pine trees about 40 yards short of the green. So you had to get it over the wall, over the swimming pool, over the pine trees. It was like mental. So I've walked down. He's walked in, and I'm just sort of like, you know, yeah, I'll just chip it out sideways, mate, you know. No, Billy. I said, yeah, chip it outside. Where's you on the green? You can still make par and win the tournament. No, Billy, I think I see the shot there. And he's looking up. I'm like, what is he looking at? He's lost the plot, this bloke.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's seen this chink of daylight to the left towards 10 o'clock, probably about 10 yards to his left. There's a little gap in the tree, size of a dinner plate. He's going, no, Billy, you'll see this. And I'm like, see what? No, maybe I go through this hole. I'm like, go get a yardage. I'm like, Jesus Christ. So I've walked up there. And I promise you, on my kid's life to this day, I'd never got a yardage. I just walked to the edge of the fairway, had a look up, I thought, yeah, 130 will do, you know. So I've walked back. How far we are, 130 yards, mate. Okay, give me the pitching wedge, So I'm like, look, I know you're Seve Ballesteros, but you're not effing Paul Daniels. Just chip it out, will you? Why? Why I listen to you? Why you put doubt in my mind, you son of my bitch? I have the shot, and you're the carry. Carry the clubs, I have this shot, now go on. And I'm walking away, tripping off my bottom lip like, thinking he's going to hit the wall, plug the ball between his eyes and kill him, so I've no boss. But more importantly, as a caddy, I'm counting my percentage money, you know, that I'm going to lose when he makes an 8. And I've walked miles away from him. Obviously, if it hits a wall and it's me, my life's not worth living, so. Anyway, he hits this shot, dust flies everywhere, and I don't hear it hit the trees. I see dust everywhere, and then all of a sudden I see this ball come through the trees, over the wall, over the swimming pool, and as the ball's now flying over the 80-foot pine trees towards the green, I can always remember thinking, as looking at the ball in mid-flight, thinking, I'm actually witnessing the best golf shot that's ever been played right here. Yeah. And it landed a yard short of the green. It was a brilliant shot, because it was all blind, and you know where we're going. It just goes to show, if I'd give him the right yardage, you might have knocked it on, but that's another story. And of course, I walked up there and he chips it in for a birdie. So I had to get down on my hands and knees, bowing to him, calling him Jesus Christ, you are the Messiah, Seve Ballesteros, you're the best that ever lived. And he was just laughing and dragged me up off the floor, like, you know. But yeah, it was an incredible moment, and one I'll never forget to the day I die. Like, brilliant.
Amazing, mate.
That's obviously the best shot you've ever witnessed. What's the second best shot you've ever witnessed then?
That 3-foot putt on Sunday for $3 million, that'll do.
No doubt about it, no shit.
I like that. further.
Struth. Yeah, mate, yeah. That's brilliant stuff.
I mean,
thanks,
you
Billy.
Also got the opportunity to caddy for Tiger Woods, just not a huge amount, but Steve Williams was away for whatever reason. Tiger called you up. That must have been an incredible experience. What was your reaction when you first got that phone call or the invite to do it? And then what was it actually like to caddy for Tiger Woods?
Well, it wasn't a phone call, actually. It was on the range at Akron, Ohio, at the Bridgestone Tournament. And Tiger came up to Darren Clark, spoke to Darren for 2 minutes, walked away. And after Darren hit about another six shots, and he looked up and says, "Do you know what that were all about?" I went, "What?" He says, "Tiger wants you to work for him at the President's Cup. Because Steve Williams' wife's having a baby." I went, "Really?" Well, obviously, this is Tiger Woods. This is like, you know, Jack Nicklaus has won 18 majors. Tiger Woods is going to win 25 majors playing left-handed at this stage.
You know, yeah.
He is the best player that's ever lived. Make no bones about it. It's just injury and you know, the personal stuff's all caught up, and it hasn't happened as yet. Never know. But anyway, he says, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I don't know." And Lee Westwood were hitting balls at the side of Darren Clark. He turned around and said, "Billy, if you don't work for him, I will." I went, "Yeah, good point, Westy, good point." Yeah, so I walked across and shook Tiger's hand. I said, "Yeah, it'd be an absolute pleasure, mate." But it was weird, really, because I got there caddying for Tiger, and, you know, you've obviously got so much respect for him. To the first tee, and it was 300 yards long, 10 deep, both sides, screaming and shouting. It was an absolute circus. My ears were bleeding with the noise levels. Tiger's hat's on sideways, his shirt's ripped, his pen marks all over him. Looks like he's just done three rounds with Anthony Joshua as he walks through the crowd. And I'm now first tee, waiting for him. And there's just me and him, nobody else. Silence. Nobody within 200 yards of us. And he walked on the tee, and I looked at him and I said, "You know what, that's the first time in 15 years I've felt that aura around a golfer." And the only other person I felt that with is Seve Ballesteros. Mm-hmm. I said, "I'm going to tell you something now." He said, "What's that, Billy?" I said, "Well, you might be a billionaire. You might be down as the best player that ever plays this game. And you might be have any woman in the world you want. But I want to up your lives." And he went, "Thanks for that, Billy. At least somebody knows what I have to put up with."
Yeah,
and that's why I don't play so much. That's exactly what I said. That's why I don't play so much. And I thought, yeah, I get it, mate. Because, you know, from being 2 year old, he was probably, I won't say bullied, but, you know, he was 2 year old. That was his sole goal, to be the best golfer. His dad wanted him to be the best golfer that ever played the game, and he got it, but it came with the price of not having a life. You know, you can't go out and sit down in a restaurant and go on holiday and sit on the beach with that. 50 people, you know, sticking a pen in your face, sign this, selfie that. It's not a nice place.
Yeah, when you become the cream de la creme of anything, that is what comes with it, isn't it?
He took up scuba diving and got his own boat on that, you know, but I think even, you know, even when in there, the fish were like going, "There's Tiger Woods," you know. I think, you know, he just wanted to get away from people, you know.
Oh, what was he like as a player to caddy for? I just got visioned of a tiger shark coming up to him and going, and them having a debate, you know, who's the real tiger.
You know, he got my attention that week for his manners. Everything he said was please or thank you, and that's the only thing I've instilled in my children, that I sat him down and basically warned him, like, "You dare ask for anything in life," for that, saying please and thank you and showing respect for people. You got me to answer to. And, you know, at this stage, my kids are 19 and 18 and they're golden. They'll never give me a minute's bother. But that's the one thing about Tiger. His manners were impeccable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was brilliant. Definitely.
I really enjoyed my time with him. I have the utmost respect for him as a person and as a player, obviously.
Well, Billy, I got a question from my mate who's a caddy. You caddied for me over in America and in Europe as well. So it's a question. Best club you've ever made? What's the best call you've ever made on the golf course, do you think?
St. Millian, 1994. Benson Edges International, caddying for Seve Ballesteros. Two-shot lead playing the last over Nick Faldo and Gary Orr. In front left over the water. And he's got, let me think if I can get this exactly right for you, Morgan. I think he had 187 metres, which is like 205 yards, roughly.
Yeah.
Which was right on his limit for a 5-iron. And I mean, listen, I mean, he got a 2-shot lead, and the lake's sort of like front left, pin's cut over the water. So I'm sort of like thinking, well, just bash a 5-iron, right edge of the green, 3-point, and win the tournament. But you know, it's Seve Ballesteros, so he ain't good. He ain't doing that, man. He's crying and that, like. So I thought, well, if he hits 5, this is all going through my head in like split seconds. Like, I'm thinking, if he hits a 5-iron here and misses any of it, it's in the water short, and then you're dropping it back, wedge on the green, playoff. So it's Billy, how far we have? Bearing in mind with 187 metres. Billy, how far we have? I said, you got 193 metres, mate. Okay, maybe a smooth 4-iron, eh? I said, yeah, perfect 4-iron, mate. And ripped this 4-iron straight at it. Went over the green out of bounds and lost the tournament.
Oh!
No, no, it didn't. I'm only joking you.
No, it never. I knew what he did.
I've honestly told him 193 metres, so I've put 6 yards on it. So he took the 5-iron out of his head and he hit 4-iron to 15 foot behind the hole and won the tournament. So, yeah, that'd be the biggest call I've made in my career. If it had gone tits up, obviously I wouldn't have told him, I'd give him the wrong yardage. But as soon as it landed on the green, I nudged him, I went, I gave the wrong yardage there. He did not find it amusing, even though he just about to win the tournament. He wanted to rip my head off.
Mate, that's so good. But I mean, honestly, to get your point across, that's sometimes what you got to do. I mean, bit of tongue in cheek and all that.
But it's funny.
Mate, this.
I was like 20. What was that? 94. So I'd have been 28 year old then. Mm-hmm. I'm 55 in a couple of weeks. Would I do that again? I wouldn't have the bottle to do that again ever. I don't know. I did it. I mean, I might stick a couple on it, but to throw 6 on it, we're like, wow. Did I really do that? Mental. Get him for him. He'd have sticking a sword through me in an heartbeat if it had gone wrong, right?
Oh, mate. Well, Louis, my mate, and he's asked you another question, one more. He said, so this pretty much on the back of that. So what's the biggest miss club you've ever given and what did it cost? I mean, it's kind of along those lines what you were saying, but I mean...
You know what? There's one that really grabs for me. And it was the Open. If I had to go back and change one decision of all time, I would carry for Darren Clark at Lytham the year David Duval won.
Yeah.
And Darren had just birdied the 16th to go to 8 under par. David Duval was 10 under playing the 12th. So I'm sort of like thinking, well, if you can finish with a birdie, the last 2 holes, get 9 under in the clubhouse, you never know, it could win, you know. So we walk, he's just birdies, and I'm walking to the 17th tee going, to 3 wood here, in 3 wood off this tee, you're 3 wood. And we get down there, and Nick Price says it, driver down there, and Darren goes, driver. And I've said, you know, just feeling a bit of breeze, and I'm like, you know what, yeah, I go on then, just hit a smooth driver, like, you know, and I let him hit driver, and he hit this knuckleball, like one of Fitz's, you know, like 10 foot off the floor. And it ran and ran and ran and ran. It must have run 80 yards because it was a bit burnt, you know.
Yeah.
And it ran out in a bunker down the left and hit it right of the green. Chipped it over the green in a bunker. Splashed it out to 2 foot and missed it. Made double bogey and finished third. And I actually shed a tear on my own that night, beating myself up thinking you're never, ever going to do that as long as you live and let somebody hit a shot that you know that you're not happy with. And that would be the... Listen, we all make mistakes, and that'd be the one that probably haunts me a little bit. But that pales in insignificance when, you know, when you think of caddy for Thomas Bjorn, when he left it in that bunker 3 times when he had the open in his pocket, I was caddying for Thomas that day. So that broke me out, and I thought about that every day for 6 months of my life.
What do you say?
It's the one tournament that means everything. I've done every Open Championship since 1975, not missed one to this day. I ain't caddying, you know, obviously caddying in everyone since 1984, but from being a 9-year-old lad at Carnoustie in 1975, I've been to every Open Championship for 45 years, like. Amazing. So it's the one tournament that means everything to me, and to, you know, and obviously caddy for Lee at Turnberry when he 3-putted the last the year Watson could have won it, you know, that's another one that got away. It's makes me want to get the stick book out at times. It's the one tournament that means so much, and but yeah, that was the one that'd be the one club I'd say.
You mentioned Bjorn there. What do you say to your player in a situation like that when you're as disappointed inside as they are? You've got the regret, but...
Listen, there were no regrets from me that day. I stood on that tee. I've been out on that golf course at 6:30 in the morning looking at every pin, and I knew you'd 5 foot to the right of that pin and it was a graveyard, or you'd half a Kent to the left.
Yeah.
And it was the easiest hole on the golf course, 6 iron. And we got on the tee, I just said, Thomas, TV tower, middle of the green, nowhere else, which were like 30 foot left. And it set off straight at the flag. I don't think it meant to hit the flag, but it... And as soon as it set off straight at the flag, I was just going, no, no, no. And of course, it took him 3 to get out of the bunker and he lost the open by a shot. But the other thing is, the first round, he hit it in the bunker on the 17th and left it in. Then hit the sand in anger, popped it out. And as we're walking off the green, he says, can you believe I did that? I said, can I believe you did what? He said, left it in that bunker, made double bogey. I said, well, you did, but then you hit the sand in anger, so it's a 2-shot penalty. So it's actually an 8, not a 6. He made 8 the first round. He was still leading by 3 with 3 holes to play, like, you know, so... So I've actually caddied for somebody that hit less shots at an Open Championship. They just didn't get the claret jug, that's all.
Oh,
but the funny thing about that,
heartbreaking.
There's been some cock-ups in Open Championship history, you know. We know the names. And yeah, we're going out for dinner the very next night in Portmarnock, Irish Open. And I'm stroking Thomas like an old golden Labrador, telling him how good he is, building up his ego. You show your peers how strong you are, you bounce back and you win this Irish Open. And funnily enough, he got beat in a playoff against Michael Campbell. He played great. But we're, you know, we're walking out of the restaurant. I've been stroking him for 2 hours, telling him how good he is, how brilliant he is. And I said, we're just going here for a pint up my own Gibney's pub in Malahide. And as we walk through the saloon doors, there's all the usual suspects there. Ernie Els, Ian Woosnam, Darren Clark, Lee Westwood, 12 caddies, whatever. Absolute silence. Nobody knows what to say to Thomas. And Darren Clark chirps up, hey, Thomas, he says, have you seen the draw for this week? And Thomas goes, no, why are we playing together, Darren? I says, no, you're playing with Doug Sands and John Vanderveld, you clumsy git. The players fell apart laughing like, but what can you do? If you didn't laugh, you'd cry. So, over it.
Oh, mate, that's the way to treat it. That is the way to treat it. Without question. That's class, Billy.
You've had an incredible insight into the many roles and things you've done over the years for your different players, and it's always, I'm sure, a little bit different for each guy. But what are the threads that run through for every single player that you've had to deliver that makes you such a good caddy?
What makes a good caddy?
Yeah.
A good player.
Mm-hmm. You're a good player.
You need a good player to be a good caddy, because no matter how good a caddy you are, if you've got a rubbish player, you ain't winning, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
So listen, you just got to be, you just got to work hard and be humble, you know, and you know, don't treat people differently because you're doing well, and you know, be humble and don't get on your high horse and think you're something special. I mean, there's one saying a guy told me years ago, one of the other caddies, there's three things in life that don't last. Dogs that chase cars, pros that put for pars, and caddies that think they're stars. And it's true.
Oh, that's a beauty. That's a beauty.
I like that.
Oh, I like that. I like that, Billy.
You've also spoken about how back in the very early days it was, you know, staying in hotels with rats, dodgy travel to get to places, no phones, no yardage.
I used to set off from Bradford on a bus overnight. I used to sleep on the bus all the way to London. So, like, I'd leave Bradford at midnight. I'd get into London at 6 o'clock in the morning, having stopped at Derby, Leicester, Peterborough, everywhere. Like, get off, get on a train for a day and a half. You know, you might be going to Barcelona, or, you know, you travel on a day and a half from tournament to tournament, you know. I had to hitchhike to a golf tour in France once and I got lost and had to sleep in a bush. But like I said, there was no money and no credit cards, you know, no internet, no phones. You know, walk around with a pocket full of 10p to phone people, you know, find a phone box at work that won't vandalise, you know. You could never afford to get in an aeroplane. You had to do house or food. You had a great life. No range balls. You have to stand out on the range and get hit by everybody else's golf balls because there are no range balls. It was a tough existence as a caddy, you know. And that's why it was full of, you know, pretty much ragabonds and gypsies and tramps, like, you know, and me.
What period was the most fun? Because obviously it's more professional.
It was great. It was great times, honestly.
You make your own fun, don't you, when in circumstances like that. That's amazing. Amazing. Love that.
It was more fun back then than it is now. I'm not knocking it now. It's a great lifestyle. You know, I always say I've been on a 38-year stag do, Morgan.
It's all right, exactly.
I have. And it's like, I always said to myself, right, I'm going to caddy for 40 years. Bearing in mind, next year will be my 39th season on tour. I've always said to myself, I'm going to caddy for 40 years. 56-year-old, get out. And then, you know, do what I want. Do a bit of skiing, you know, start playing a bit of golf myself again, you know, because I haven't really played golf for 20 years. And after this lockdown, I thought, you know what? I'm keeping on caddying. I'm going to keep going.
Bloody right. I'm not going to be a fluff cow.
I'm going to be a fluff cow, but I might go a little bit nearer to 60 than I ever envisaged. But we'll see. I might start doing a bit of a job share or caddying less or whatever. But it's in my blood. I'm a gypsy. You know, it's part of my life. That's Band of Brothers on tour, isn't it? And it's as you know, it's great fun out there with the lads and travelling around, and I enjoy it. So why would you want to give it up anytime soon?
I can see you with a big white moustache, mate, looking like Fluff in about 10 years' time.
God, yeah. I noticed myself, I was giving Wesley a bit of a hug on the 18th green. You know, obviously Fitz had won and he'd won the money. So it was great for both of us, you know. Somebody had taken a picture. And I saw this picture on the internet or Instagram or something. I thought, who was that old get hugging Westy there? Silver badger, like. And then I realised it was me. I was like, oh, my God. I thought I were a badger, but there's no black now. I'm just silver.
You mentioned Westy again there. We touched on it briefly earlier, but obviously you had 10 years with him, and to see what he's achieved in the game and the longevity he's had, to now win at 47 years old, his third Race to Dubai Order of Merit title, and you're close friends with him, of course, as well. How do you assess the enormity of what Westy has been able to achieve over the amount of time he's done it as well?
Well, I mean, he's arguably, you know, one of the best ball strikers has been for the last 25 years. How long has he been out there? 26. Totally. So he's, you know, I look at the people I've had the pleasure of being out with or the players I've worked for. And, you know, if I had to choose a couple of players, I'd say they're the best ball strikers. It'd be Lee Westwood and Sergio Garcia. You know, the guys I've worked for, you know, the pressure they put on the golf ball, the incredible accuracy they have and the trajectory that, you know, it's like Lee could hit a golf shot. And I know if I've done my job right, given the right yardage and advise the right wind, when that ball were at the top of its flight with 100 yards, they go, I could tell you that were within 10 feet. His control of his distance control is incredible. You know, and he's a lot happier in his life and less stress on it. He's taking more control of his own destiny with doing his own yardages, etc. He's more focused. He's not got that outside influence that he used to have. And he's, you know, he's happy in his own skin and he's fitter than he's ever been. Obviously, the technology allows you to go on that much longer than it used to do back in Wuzzy's and Faldo's day. You know, you used to get to 40 years old and you were pretty much finished.
Yeah.
And now he's 48 in April and he's, you know, there he's just won the money list again. And he's starting to put nicely. He's gone to the claw grip after all these years. And, you know, he tried it a few years ago and it worked. And he didn't use it again the next week to my disgust. But, but no, he looks pretty comfortable on the greens as well. So, he's going to make another Ryder Cup team, which, if he'd said 4 years ago at Hazeltine, you probably said he won't make another. But there you go. He will.
Yeah.
By the looks of it. And he's playing as good a golf as he's played for. You know, he's fit and as strong as ever. He's in the gym every day. So he's a strong, strong lad. He's an ox, you know. So, and he still drives the ball great. And he was telling me last week he's got a new driver. He's hitting it 10 or 15 yards further with it. So there you go. He's still got the game. And, you know, and everybody says, oh, Westy never won a major. And Monty never won a major. Don't write him off yet. He could still win a major.
Don't write him off. Yeah. Well, mate, in the Masters, that just gone, actually. He was my bet, as Kip will tell you. I actually fancy Westy, and I still fancy it. First time, actually, I haven't, but, you know, kind of put the, I'm not a better man, but, you know, I normally go for Westy every time, but I knew he was a little bit injured, so I didn't go for him at, but beware the injured golfer, obviously, at Dubai. But, Matt, what I was going to ask you was, Billy, so when I was on tour in America, I was on tour in Europe, what's the difference? I mean, I used to hang out with Michael Collins, who does the ESPN tour caddy over there.
Yeah, and, he looks like he's swallowed a Swiss ball now, doesn't he?
Well, he wasn't as big as that when I first met him, I tell you that. But we were both based down in Miami. And what's the difference between the way the caddies are set up in Europe and how they're looked after compared to America? Because there was always that kind of debate on how, you know, caddies were getting treated in, you know, each side of the Atlantic. You know, is there a good put up for caddies?
I'd actually say the caddies in Europe better. It's better for the caddies in Europe regarding, you know, the food that they get served. You know, they're allowed in the locker room, they're allowed in the clubhouses. In America, you get fed. I mean, my little dog's lying here now, but I won't feed him what we get over there. You're not allowed in the clubhouse, you're not allowed in the locker rooms. It's very much, you know, you're a third class. You know, you're not treated equally, and that really winds me up. And I can't believe that we're up with it to a certain degree over there. But
that's surprising you say that, though, Billy, because that's what it was like when I was there, mate. I thought that had changed by now.
But the flip side is they play for three times the amount of money they play in Europe. So you have your cake and eat it. So it's great over there, but it's certainly different to Europe.
Yeah.
Just before we let you go, Billy, there's one thing that always amuses me when I see you and Matt playing, and that's when you both reach for the yardage books at the same time. And Matt's got the Sheffield United badge on his. You've got the Leeds United badge.
Dirty Leeds, get in there.
I always have a little chuckle to myself when I see that. What's the chat been like between you two around football this year? Because Sheffield United had a very good debut season in the Premier League, had the upper hand, but Leeds definitely the better team this year.
Well, it looks like Sheffield United in Eurovision Song Contest at the minute, don't they? And Pois. You know, they're not doing very well, are they? But listen, last year we're tortured because obviously it was to go up from the champion the year before to go up from the Championship into the Premier League. It's obviously worth 200 million, isn't it? And it's a chance to get back in the big time again and build your squad up and all that. So it's important. And he's a proper football fan. It absolutely destroys him if Sheffield United get beat. So we had good camaraderie and, you know, a good bit of fun with each other last year. But it actually came down to Sheffield United and Leeds for the second spot, basically. And Sheffield United beat Leeds 1-0 at Elland Road, which I must say, he didn't gloat because I think he's a bit scared of me at times. I think I'd have given him a knuckle sandwich, like, you know. So he's very respectful. We don't give each other too much grief on the football front. But, you know, I think we both respect each other on that front. But yeah, it's good fun, and I enjoy the banter. He's clued up with his football, and he sounds like he was a pretty handy little player himself. Like, so.
Well, mate, match made in heaven, buddy. Thanks, Billy. Legend, man.
Pleasure, mate.
Awesome to have Billy Foster with us there, of course, off the back of the win with Matt Fitzpatrick and the DP World Tour Championship as well. So thank you to Billy for his time. And last week, we promised you an absolute knockout motor caddy competition, and we are delivering on that with thanks to our sponsors, Motor Caddy. We have got an M7 remote trolley to give away. So that RRP for £999.99. So that is a serious bit of kit. It's the ultimate in hands-free electric trolleys, part of the award-winning M series range that has the slim fold system, making it possible to fit into the smallest of car boots. It not only features a rechargeable remote control handset, but other features are anti-glare LCD screen, USB charging port, adjustable handle height, a pair of anti-skid rear wheels, an extra removable anti-tip wheel at the back, so it's stable on all terrains. It's got an ergonomic remote control handset, so easy to use. You can switch it from remote to manual mode and back again. So simple. Absolutely brilliant. Downhill control as well, so brakes if you play somewhere slopey. I mean, everything you can think of you'd want on an electric trolley, and actually quite a few things you never knew you needed, but definitely do are on there, John. I know you're a big fan of a bit of kit like this. Now you're getting a little bit older, you don't like to carry anymore. What a cool prize that is.
Well, if anyone don't want it, I'll have it off them, because I want one. I want one. I mean, they're amazing. I've seen them in action. I've seen them, you know, it's the top of the range jobby. I mean, they've got so many great products, Motor Caddy. And that's just one of many that are absolutely fantastic. But lucky person whoever gets to win this baby, because you can pack your lunchbox in there as well and go round and enjoy your round of golf. It can hold on to everything. It might be even able to hold on to you if you want a free ride with a remote. That'd be hilarious.
Absolutely. So there's one way you can win this amazing prize, and that is to go to motocaddy.com/filthylipout and answer the following question. How far did Billy Foster tell Seve Ballesteros he had to the hole when the Spaniard hit his wonder shot on the 18th hole at Crans, Montana in 1993? Is it A, 120 yards, B, 130 yards, C, 140 yards, or D, 150 yards? Now, you may already know this because he mentioned it earlier in this podcast. If you're sitting there thinking, oh, I don't know the answer to that, just go back a little bit in the pod and you will find out the answer. Billy revealed all in one of his many amazing stories about Seve. That's all we've got time for this week. Get your entries in inside the next 7 days because we are going to be announcing the winner on next week's pod, which will be out Tuesday afternoon, Tuesday evening. So we'll be drawing the winner Tuesday morning next week, the Tuesday before Christmas. So get your answers in as quick as you can at motocaddy.com/filthylipout. And thank you to Billy for coming on. Remember, like, share, subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. Please leave reviews and 5-star ratings as well, because it all helps us get found. And we will see you again next week. Woohoo!